Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York's legislative session may have officially ended Thursday, but the work isn't over. Lawmakers are still trying to tie up loose ends, but with hundreds of bills still unresolved, what happens next? We'll check in with political reporter Jimmy Vielkind of the New York Public News Network for the latest on Albany's unfinished business. When we think of postpartum depression, we usually think of moms, but dads can struggle too. Today we're marking International Father's Mental Health Day. Talking about the emotional challenges new dads face, we'll hear from Dr. Daniel Singley of Postpartum Support International and from dads who've lived through it, breaking the stigma, recognizing the signs, and supporting others' mental health. Plus, local economic perspective with James B. Huntington and the Small Wood Porch Fest preview. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. This is the fourth day of fighting between Israel and Iran. It is not easing. Iran has been firing ballistic missiles into Israel, and Israeli officials say at least 20 people have been killed. In Iran, at least 224 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, according to the Iranian Health Ministry. NPR's Jane Araf reports.
Iran says many of the casualties across the country were women and children. They were killed and injured in Israeli airstrikes that began Friday, targeting what Israel says are nuclear facilities, military commanders, and top scientists. The Iranian government says dozens of the women and children were killed when a residential complex collapsed in an Israeli attack. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has called on the UN Security Council to condemn Israel's attacks. Israel says they're aimed at preventing Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Iran says its uranium enrichment program is for peaceful purposes. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
President Trump had said online the U.S. was not involved in earlier Israeli airstrikes on Iran. But in an interview with ABC News over the weekend, Trump said, quote, "It's possible we could get involved, but we are not at this moment involved," end quote. Stocks opened higher this morning as oil prices eased. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped by about 440 points in early trading.
Stocks regained some of the ground they lost last week after Israel launched airstrikes on Iran. Oil prices, which initially spiked after the attack, has since fallen back a bit. Retail gasoline prices in the U.S. rose only modestly over the weekend. AAA says the average price of regular gas is about $3.14 a gallon, up a penny and a half from a week ago, but still substantially lower than this time last year. Consumer spending in China is up, with retail sales in the world's second-largest economy growing more than 6% in the last year. China's factory output is also growing, but not as fast as it had been. Stocks rose overnight in both Hong Kong and Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities have arrested the suspect in the shooting of two Minnesota Democratic lawmakers and their spouses. Two victims were killed. The victims reportedly appeared on lists in the suspect's possession. U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota says her name was on one of the lists, too. She says all members of Minnesota's congressional delegation in both parties have signed one statement rejecting the violence. Klobuchar says that everyone must work together to bring down the anger in political rhetoric.
We need people who are willing to get things done, willing to take tough votes and make decisions that are best for this country, and willing to actually bring down the rhetoric.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. You're listening to NPR. West Virginia's governor has declared emergencies in two counties after deadly flooding over the weekend. At least five people have died in flash flooding and several others are missing. A flood watch is still posted for most of West Virginia. Authorities in Texas say at least 13 people were killed by flash flooding that hit the San Antonio area late last week. From Texas Public Radio, Joey Palacios reports 6 inches of rain fell in just 3 hours, washing vehicles into a flooded creek.
The San Antonio Fire Department spent days combing through two search areas on opposite sides of the city. At least 15 mangled cars and trucks were lifted out of a creek by crane. 10 survivors were rescued, some who were hanging from trees. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says the impact of the flooding has been devastating.
Thankfully, everyone who has been reported missing has been recovered. Unfortunately, we know there's a significant loss of life in what has been the worst flooding event we've had in well over a decade.
The identified victims range in age from their 20s to their 60s. An investigation into how so many cars were swept away is ongoing. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
Protesters in Spain have again expressed anger at over-tourism. On Sunday, activists used water pistols to splash unsuspecting tourists in Barcelona and on the Spanish island of Mallorca. Some Spaniards say that their rent prices are rising because more apartments in their cities are being set aside for tourists. Hundreds of people turned out to march against over-tourism in southern Spain yesterday. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York State's legislative session technically ended Thursday, but there's still work to be done. Lawmakers worked through the night Thursday to wrap up negotiations, but hundreds of bills remain up in the air. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke to Capitol reporter Jimmy Vielkind for an update on negotiations.
New York State's legislative session technically ended Thursday, but there's still work to be done. Lawmakers worked through the night Thursday to wrap up negotiations, but hundreds of bills remain up in the air. I spoke with reporter Jimmy Vielkind of the New York Public News Network for an update on negotiations.
One is legislation that would update New York's consumer protection laws that would give the state attorney general, in this case it's Letitia James, more of a role. Traditionally, the federal government has been mostly the consumer watchdog. There's even a new agency that was created a few decades ago, the Consumer Financial Protection Board, that have really stepped up and regulated products, financial products, other products that Americans come to rely on. But state officials, including James, say that the Trump administration has been retreating from this kind of watchdog role. She asked for an update to New York's laws that would let her have more power to step in and do more things. So that's something that has cleared the state Senate, but we're unclear whether it's going to be voted upon by the state assembly. There's another measure that would put a moratorium on the spreading of biosolids, which is basically kind of sewage waste that is often used as fertilizer on farm fields. There have been some instances that our public media colleagues have reported on in which nearby water wells have seen some kind of discoloration and potential contamination. So this legislation would put a moratorium on the spreading of that while it's studied. That, again, is something that cleared the Senate, is pending in the state assembly. And then a final kind of basket of important items has to do with regulations on artificial intelligence. There was one bill which passed both houses already that would mandate safety plans for some of the bigger AI models. There's another bill that would restrict how algorithms are used in social media. That seems pretty dead. The state Senate did not take it up. But a final bill that's still a live ball would put some guardrails on how AI applications are used for things like deciding who could get a loan or who would be granted a job interview.
So what's fully dead for the year?
Well, one item that has seemed to be fully dead is the New York for All Act. Now, dozens of people have been coming consistently to the state capitol to push for this, and it's a bill which would restrict how local police agencies can cooperate with ICE and other federal immigration authorities. Advocates for the measure say it's necessary as the Trump administration ramps up its deportations. We've seen instances in the capital region in Cahoes. I reported about a story in Rotterdam in which two undocumented immigrants were accused of shoplifting from a grocery store. But because they were not citizens, they were handed over to ICE and they are now detained pending deportation. Opponents of this measure say that it essentially would protect undocumented immigrants who commit crimes, even after they've already entered the country illegally. They say it's an unfair double standard. And, you know, Sam, of course, this is a big issue nationally. We're seeing continued civil unrest in Los Angeles as people began to protest the deportations that were happening there. And President Trump called in the National Guard and deployed U.S. Marines to the area. And then on Friday, we saw there was an escape from an ICE detention facility in New Jersey. So this is certainly something in the headlines, and it seems that New York lawmakers aren't going to take any real action regarding immigration this year.
What bills have passed completely since the budget was passed last month?
There's a bill that would increase oversight of the state's prison system, and that's been important this year, lawmakers say, because of the recent beating deaths of two incarcerated people, as well as a three-week wildcat strike, which went across the system and sort of followed the criminal charges that were brought in the wake of those deaths. This legislation would do a number of things, including empowering and expanding watchdog groups that already are charged with monitoring conditions in the state's correctional facilities. The bill would also require that there are more cameras be posted inside prisons, covering basically every area except for a toilet and an inmate's cell. This would eliminate dead zones, which proponents of this legislation say is important because there have been areas where inmates say they are abused consistently by guards, and a fact pattern that emerged in the beating deaths of those two incarcerated people earlier this year.
So that was past Thursday, the last day of the session. Was it controversial?
Well, yes, for a few reasons. The bill's Democratic sponsor said this was an important step toward increasing transparency, oversight, and making meaningful reforms to the system. But Republicans said that it doesn't really address some of the safety complaints that they've heard from correctional officers and guards who work in the system, the same people who went illegally on strike for 3 weeks earlier this year. They say that rising violence is the key issue in the state's prisons, and they're looking for more people to be hired and for more disciplinary measures, which they say will help them keep the incarcerated population more in line and maintain discipline in facilities. On the other side of the political spectrum, there are progressive groups who said that this legislation was a lost opportunity. They wanted the legislature to include more provisions that would let people out of jails, that would decrease the incarcerated population. One specific measure would make elderly prisoners eligible for parole based upon their age and their length of service.
Do you think that's the biggest headline from the end of the legislative session this year? Medical aid in dying also passed after many years. What do you think made the difference after so many years of inaction on that bill?
Well, I think you're exactly right. The Medical Aid in Dying, or as opponents call it, the Physician-Assisted Suicide Bill, did pass the state assembly last month, and it cleared the state Senate on Monday. That's been the product of a years-long campaign, mostly by advocates who have quietly demonstrated at the Capitol, many of them with pictures of loved ones who have terminal illnesses, and they say wanted to avail themselves of life-ending measures, and they say take control of the end of their life. I think those personal stories, which accumulated over time, really started to sway a bunch of lawmakers. But it wasn't a blowout vote. It was pretty close. In both the state assembly and the state senate, we saw some Democrats defect from their party and join Republicans in voting against it. Some of them said that they worried there would be racial disparities in how aid in dying or physician-assisted suicide is implemented, and others said that they felt that disabled people might be coerced into ending their lives. So it's been a really tricky issue for a lot of people and really led to some very heartfelt and personal debate.
So now that it's passed both houses, Governor Kathy Hochul will need to sign it. Has she said anything about it?
That's really a million-dollar question, Sam. We haven't heard much of anything from Governor Hochul about this legislation. Her spokesperson has sort of a stock line for all these bills, both the prison oversight bill, the aid in dying or physician-assisted suicide bill, which is that the governor will review it when it goes to her desk. There are going to be hundreds of measures that clear both houses, some of them very, very low level, some of them more high profile like these bills, and we'll have to see exactly what the governor says. What she often does is try to negotiate changes to bills, which are known as chapter amendments, after they reach her desk, and then she will sign them in exchange for sort of revisions to the law that happen ex post facto.
In the final days of session, did Hochul interact with lawmakers at all?
No, she was relatively absent presence at the state capitol, which is in contrast to some of the other legislative sessions I've covered. She said previously that she worked very hard to enact her agenda as part of the $254 billion state budget. Now, you and listeners might remember that that budget was adopted several weeks late, and it was notable not just for the billions of dollars, and I don't know if you'd say billions and billions of cents, that it allocated, but also for policies including a bell-to-bell ban on smartphones in schools, or changes to the discovery laws, which govern how evidence is shared before a criminal trial. Instead, the biggest thing that Hochul did this week was go down to Washington, D.C. She was called down there by Republicans who control the House Oversight Committee. GOP members who run that body brought in Hochul along with two other blue state governors, J.B. Pritzker of Illinois and Tim Walz of Minnesota, to talk about sanctuary policies, which restrict law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration officials. Hochul got grilled by several New Yorkers, including Representative Elise Stefanik, who represents the North Country. Stefanik read the names of a string of undocumented immigrants who have been arrested for high-profile crimes and asked, "Do you know who these people are? Do you know who these people are?" Hochul said she didn't, and Stefanik sort of tried to put her on the spot, saying that New Yorkers know who these people are. Here, let's listen to the end of their exchange.
January. We deserve a governor who stands up for law-abiding New Yorkers, doesn't put illegals first, but actually puts New Yorkers first. I appreciate
rather than going after the viral moment, I suggest you look at the facts.
No. I'm standing up.
So Hochul insisted that New York cooperates with ICE when people are convicted of a crime. But Republicans weren't satisfied. They noted that she has continued an executive order which restricts state employees from asking about a person's immigration status in all but a very, very few instances. Democrats said this whole hearing was just political theater. So at the end of the day, it just sort of ground to, I don't know, political stalemate.
Stefanik and Mike Lawler, who Hochul testified before on Thursday, are both considering a run for governor. What do you think about the dynamic between Lawler and Stefanik, two possible GOP candidates?
Well, they've sort of been operating in parallel, and that was also true at the hearing on Thursday. Stefanik was one of the first members to ask questions. She's one of the more senior people in the House leadership, whereas Lawler came really toward the end of the day. Lawler used his time to sort of push Hochul on that legislation I mentioned, the New York for All Act. He asked, would you sign this law? Would you sign this bill? Would you sign this bill? And Hochul, as I also said, didn't really tip her hat. But she did, quite presciently, say, I have no expectation that it will pass. You know, at the same time, both Lawler and Stefanik have come to the state capitol in Albany. Lawler was there in January. He actually offered the Republican Party's official response to Hochul's State of the State agenda address. And Stefanik was in Albany earlier this week. She stood with Republicans, who, of course, are in the minority in both the New York State Senate and New York State Assembly, about how they're concerned with the Democratic agenda. They say it's driving up costs. They say it has contributed to an erosion of public safety. And Stefanik called Hochul, this has become her tagline, the worst governor in America. So, you know, they're both trying to stake their claim. They're both trying to get in the news. And they're also both very clearly trying to establish connections with prominent political people from around the state. And the state legislature is a pretty good place to do that. You know, if I can put on my analyst hat for a second, it seems that Lawler is trying to gain the more moderate lane in a potential Republican primary. He is focusing on how he's worked with Democrats, and he has tried to keep Donald Trump at something of a distance. Stefanik is taking a very different approach. She, in Albany on Monday, emphasized how she thought President Trump was doing a great job. She emphasized how important she thinks it is for the Congress to adopt what Trump calls the Big Beautiful Bill. That is a big package of budget cuts as well as tax cuts that represents the bulk of the Republican Party's fiscal agenda. And so she's sort of more of a red meat Trumpier person when it comes to the primary. And it's also important, Sam, to remember that she's the bigger dog. She's been in office for longer. She has more seniority in the Congress. She has a higher national profile. And she has more money in her campaign war chest. So we'll see the side contest between Lawler and Stefanik continue, I think, for the next few months, though Lawler has said he will make a decision about whether or not he runs for governor or tries to seek re-election to his Hudson Valley seat at some point in the month of June. So it could be months, it could just be a few weeks.
And lastly, Governor Hochul's former running mate, Antonio Delgado, announced his campaign recently for governor against Hochul. Do you think this changes the way Hochul carries herself throughout the rest of her term?
Well, I was actually at Delgado's first campaign event, which was held in the backyard of a church in Brooklyn. And it's very clear to me that he is staking out a lane on Hochul's left flank. He talked about things that progressive advocates are asking for, but that Hochul has been reluctant to embrace. He accused her of having sort of narrow-minded leadership. So I do think that this will have an effect. Hochul is in the unenviable position of having challengers coming at her from both the left and right. Usually it's easy to hold the center, but it's difficult if you don't know which side of the battlefield that you should be fighting on. So I do expect that we might see Delgado's run put some pressure on Hochul to nod a little bit more heavily toward progressives. That was something that seemed to be lacking in this legislative session that is concluding now in Albany. But in the next year, in the election year, it's something that she may have to do in order to win over key Democratic constituencies who she wants to count on in a primary against Delgado and anybody else who jumps in the race.
WNYC's Capitol reporter Jimmy Vielkind of the New York Public News Network.
And thanks to Samantha Simmons from the New York Public News Network and WAMC for that. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Have you heard what your neighbors are saying about the threat to public media?
I think that's totally unacceptable.
WJFF connects our whole community together.
We depend on truth, we depend on accuracy, and we depend on fair press.
I'm definitely protesting against any cuts to our local station.
Public radio is under threat, and the stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Monday, and that means working 9 to 5. Time to talk to our own local economist and author, James B. Huntington. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
You've got some numbers on unemployment rates, the latest unemployment rates for our listening area. What can you tell us?
Yes, and they're looking awfully good. These are numbers for April, the most recent month that came out. They are not seasonally adjusted. Sullivan County, 2.9% unemployment, down 1%. Orange County, 3.1%, down 0.8%. Ulster County, 2.9%, down 0.9%. Wayne County, 3.9%, down 0.8%. And Pike County, 4.4%, down 0.4%. With the national unemployment rate dropping to 3.9%, down 0.3%. These look awfully good. I mean, we have a seasonal improvement from March to April, which got in here, but the data is much better than that. Something very good is happening with jobs in our area, especially in the three New York counties.
Oh, that's good. Does that good news extend into the national inflation picture? How did things happen there with the latest data?
Well, that was not quite as good as before. We have the Consumer Price Index, which came out last week, went up 0.1% in May and up 2.4% on an annual basis. That's good. That's reasonable. It's certainly nothing special. It is going up. The core prices, which exclude gasoline and food, were also up 0.1%, 2.8% on the annual basis. Both of them were a little bit below. Each one was, well, the first one was 0.2%. It was supposed to be three times that much at 0.3% and 2.9% for the annual basis. Food prices in May rose 0.3%, making 2.9% higher annually. The food at home index and the food away from home index each rose 0.3% for the month, and they are up 2.2% and 3.8% on an annual basis. Egg prices were down to 2.7%. They're still high, but the gap is narrowing month by month, really. That all of this may affect the Fed's decision to raise interest rates or not this week, because they were planning on breaking even, and now that decision is probably even more solid. There's nothing here that calls for any big change.
And despite widespread fears to the contrary, President Trump's tariffs have yet to show up in any of this data measuring inflation. Why is that?
Yes, well, this is various economists speaking out on this. It's not turning up much at all, as we would have thought, that they're not showing up, but they are still affecting prices. They're just not significant enough to turn up in these broad inflation measures we have. They are expecting that the impact will be a lot greater this summer. We have Americans being choosier about how they spend their money. We have some that have taken a few months and haven't turned up in terms of how much customers are being charged. What they have an example here of washing machines. They were directly affected by the tariffs. This is actually from 2018. They did not get more expensive, but after 5 months, the higher costs were passed on almost 100% to consumers. So we haven't had a lot of tariffs actually taking effect yet. So much of the time, the great majority of the time, they've been announced and argued over and negotiated, and they've ended up not taking effect at all. So we'll see later this summer. Some projections are that in July and August, the data is going to show quite a bit more inflation, up to maybe a 3% pace instead of the 2.3, 2.4 things we're getting now. So hang on, we may still get them now. I mean, the good side also is that tariffs may not be showing up on a lot of products we are buying. Mm-hmm.
Folks worried about Social Security. Once you turn 62, of course, you're allowed to claim Social Security at any time. But what are some signs that you're not ready to file for Social Security?
Well, this is from the Motley Fool, who's been a very good investment advisor over the last few decades, actually. Three things that should stop you from going off and filing, at least now, are: one, if you have no idea what monthly benefit you're in line for. It goes up 8% a year until age 70, but do you know the numbers? Do you have an idea of what exactly it will do? Number two, if you don't know what your annual retirement expenses will amount to, you'll need to calculate, figure out really how much it will be, so you can be more informed when you make a decision on whether you want Social Security now or want to wait a while for a larger monthly payment. Number three, if, likewise, you haven't calculated the amount of yearly income your nest egg will provide, we have to look at that, knowing how much we have, if we have extra money on top of Social Security. If we don't, I presume you've already started taking it. But if you have your other money, you should be figuring out what it's going to bring in and really running all these numbers and having an idea for what it's going to look like with or without Social Security. Projecting, you can project out several years also, and think that most likely your savings will grow but do something. Calculate some of these things. There's no need to go off half-cocked. Get these things figured out before you make that big decision.
All right. Let's look at what's happening with the numbers. It looks like the stock market's rebounding a bit. What can you tell us in terms of where the numbers are and what's changed?
As of early this morning, very early this morning, gold, 34.14 an ounce. That's up 91. It's back on our big news event this week. Silver, 36.34, up only 4 cents. It did most of its gaining last week, but it held its gain. Ratio between silver and gold is now 94 to 1, which is lower than it was a few weeks ago. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,198, dropped 565 over the week. Mixed. We had good and bad days. Overall down. Much the same happened with NASDAQ, 19,407 for a loss of 123. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, went way up. $72.65, $8.22 on our news item. Bitcoin, $107,183, up $1,447. It seems to like what's going on. It's been quite solid. I don't know if it will last or not. British pound, 1.3580. Up almost nothing, almost unchanged. The euro, though, 1.1580, went up a penny and a half. Stronger somehow. Japanese 100 yen coin held at 69 cents. And the big news event I've been talking about is the Israel and Iran, in effect, war. It's endangering oil areas and causing people in a lot of countries to buy the safe haven things like the metals. So that's where we are. It's also has pushed up, I mentioned pushing up gas prices or oil prices, so they probably will turn up at the pumps, unfortunately, quickly.
Yeah, and some investors optimistic this morning that that conflict will remain contained. We'll wait and see here, though. James B. Huntington joins us every Monday for Local Economic Perspective. And have a good week, James B. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, marking International Father's Mental Health Day today by talking about the emotional challenges that new dads and dads faced. That's coming up next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, NACL.org, and from listeners like you.
I'm Sabrina Artel. Join me for conversations with all kinds of people in the studio, on the street, and the kitchen table of my vintage travel trailer. That's Trailer Talk, Monday night at 7:30 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Yesterday was Father's Day. Today, International Father's Mental Health Day, a time to shine a light on an often overlooked issue, the mental health of new dads. While public awareness around postpartum depression in mothers has grown in recent years, many are still unaware that fathers, too, can face serious emotional struggles during the prenatal period. Research shows that 1 in 10 new fathers experience paternal postpartum depression, and the risk doubles when their partners are also affected. Patricio Rubio spoke with Dr. Daniel Singley from Postpartum Support International, along with several dads who shared their lived experiences. They discuss how to recognize the signs, why paternal mental health matters, and how to help new fathers feel less alone.
I am a dad. My kids are now 20 and 18. As a psychologist, my area of specialty generally is the psychology of men and men's issues, but my research is on paternal perinatal mental health, or the dude to dad transition. And in that way, I've been able to work with nearly 1,000 dads over the years, and some of whom have really, really struggled with depression, with anxiety, with substance stuff, video gaming, relationship difficulties, and all the above. And what you said earlier about sometimes the way that depression plays out for men, that kind of agitated, angry, you know, overusing substances, being isolated, that's very accurate, that a lot of fathers will manifest depression that way instead of like the stereotypical can't get out of bed, sort of weepy in the morning kind of thing. So people miss it.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that. You know, what are some, like you might, I mentioned some of them and you mentioned also, but what are some of the signs that, that someone can sort of look out for themselves or maybe other folks can look out that they might be affected by this?
So on the depression front, it's some dads manifest depressive symptoms that are exactly what you typically see in the DSM, right? Our diagnostic statistical manual. But like we were saying, looking for fathers, particularly right around the first 3 to 5 months postpartum, that's oftentimes when the symptoms for dads will spike, which is different. More commonly with moms, you're looking to do that differential diagnosis between just sort of typical first month baby blues right at 4 weeks and then see, is this major depressive disorder? But that doesn't really map on to dads. So there's the time frame of it to look at, but also the way that it plays out for a lot of dads is it looks like anger and irritation. It looks like social isolation, which doesn't mean you're not around people, right? You can be around people at work. You can live in a multi-generational household. You can be a member of a faith-based community, whatever it is. And so you're around people, but he's just not really engaging or connecting. And as I said, I talked about, you know, increase in different kinds of, it's not just substance use. It really kind of any dopaminergic activity that gets the cerebral joy juice going. So it could be drugs. It could be alcohol. It could also be video gaming, risky sex, gambling, shoplifting for that matter. And then finally, there's what we call somaticizing. And this is an interesting one. Somaticizing just means taking a psychological experience and turning into a physiological one. And this kind of aligns with a lot of times the shame and the stigma that fathers will experience at having depression or having anxiety at a time when we're all taught you're supposed to be happy and rainbows and unicorns. And really, nobody says like, you know, hey, 1 in 10 dads gets postpartum depression. 1 in 2 dads gets postpartum depression when his partner has it. And that somaticizing or I can't be depressed. I'm a dude. I'm a dad. However, I can have migraines. I can have chest tightness. Like I feel like there's a weight on me or something. Those are other key ways to look for depression. On the anxiety side, a lot of times it's hypervigilance, meaning I'm like super focused on one aspect, like the bottles aren't clean enough or the schedule has to be exactly right, along with avoidance or just avoidance. Like if I have a lot of anxiety about my baby, I will find every reason in the book to avoid it or my partner or whatever the trigger is.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned the statistic that 1 in 10 men are affected by this. And if the mother is also affected by this, it goes up to the 1 in 2. Why is that? Is it, I'm assuming just because two folks are dealing with this in a household, it just escalates or?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I do quite a lot of training. You know, I work with Postpartum Support International. And I get this question a lot. And sort of the way that I'll frame it is, yeah, you know, typically the ones who get screened, right? The ones that most likely are going to get screened are the moms. And it's the 50% of the time when moms are depressed, so are their partners. And most of the research is on het couples. And so it's the mom gets assessed, the mom's depressed. And then half of the time, which is a massive public mental health number, so do the dads. In those kinds of couples. And sometimes what I get is, aren't you just blaming the moms for the dads having difficulty? Absolutely not. Really, this research finding, and it's a pretty robust one in the literature that we see over and over again, to me is more of a testament to how central that co-parental relationship is between the parents. So that if one of them is struggling, then it naturally translates to the other one struggling through that connection and through the relationship. The good news is it goes the other way. Like the rising tide will float all boats. When one person starts to have their depression remit or feel better, it'll oftentimes bring the other one along with them too. And it's interesting, like that's one of the ways that I'll talk with dads about that are kind of in denial about, I'm not depressed, but they have all the symptoms that we just talked about. And it's like, look, dude, you can do this for yourself. And that will also, that will bring along, like, this is not just for you. This is for your whole family systems. And a lot of times it's getting into that protect, provide role and framing it that way and letting the dad know that really one of the most important things that he can provide is the healthiest version of himself. And there's tons of research to support that point.
Yeah. Now, you know, like let's say if you look through social media, you see a lot of these memes, like, you know, like, oh, you know, if you're a man, you got a problem, well, deal with it. I said, no one really cares. That's a meme I see a lot at least on my timeline.
Sure.
Why do you think we don't hear much about this for men? Parental mental health disorders and dad. Why do you think this is not such a topic that's even talked about? Even when we're having a baby and going to, you know, the doctor's office for the wellness visits and things like that. I don't remember even hearing about this.
It's definitely multifaceted. One key aspect that I think underscores the why here is, generally speaking, this area of mental health is called maternal mental health. Whereas really, it's most properly parental mental health. And within that, there are some areas that are exclusively maternal, others that are exclusively paternal. But generally speaking, when we're talking about the transition to parenthood, it really is parental mental health, but words matter, right? And so if we think of this in terms of simply a mom's issue, like a good friend of mine once made the observation that if you don't think something exists, you won't even look for it. And so there's the terminology, but there's also the sort of kind of cultural sense of what it means to be a man. And, you know, you ask your average guy, hey, what does it mean to be a father? And it's you protect, you provide, you sacrifice. And agreed, like, these are noble aspects of being a person, of being a man, of being a father. The tricky part is hardly anyone tells these fathers that, yes, protecting and providing and sacrificing for the ones that you love is very important and necessary in a lot of circumstances. However, there are going to be other times when you, dad, are going to need to allow others to protect you, to provide for you, and to sacrifice for you. But that's a major violation of the orthodox bro code, right? We don't necessarily think about that. And then when you do the fatherhood thing, it's that aspect of being a man really gets ramped up, and it's guys struggle with stigma about mental health. Shame, like, I don't give myself permission to feel down because it's my wife who's staying up all night, is exhausted, or, you know, nipples are cracked, and what am I doing? Like, I don't get to have self-care or go, you know, talk to somebody about what I'm struggling with. These are some of the key factors, I think.
Yeah. So what happens when you yourself may be noticing these symptoms, or other ones may be noticing symptoms in you and looking to maybe tell you, hey, you may need help? Because I from what I experienced and what other folks have taught me, that sometimes men can get defensive. Like you mentioned, like, you know, like, hey, you need some help. Like, I don't need the help. I'm not, nothing's wrong with me. You know, it's hard to sort of break through that and make a person realize that they do need help.
It is. It's absolutely right. It's funny. I was just laughing because the literature on men's and fathers' help seeking, in particular mental health help seeking, is that we just don't do it. You know, it's the only, I don't even ask for directions, let alone help, which is funny because a lot of times the way that we teach boys and men about being a man is you have a team, right? Like, we're socialized to look at transactional relationships and to be parts of teams. However, when it comes to this sort of thing, the shame typically causes us to self-isolate. And so when somebody comes and is, bro, you kind of seem off or down or whatever, the tendency is, you know, the platitudes. It's all good. It is what it is. I'm letting it roll off my back, like this kind of stuff. And sometimes it can be really helpful to hear it not from their partner, but from another dad or from another dude who can normalize. Yeah, man, sometimes you're rocking it and you do great over here. Other times there's a part of our lives when it can be really struggling and having difficulty. And that's one of the reasons why. So I work with Postpartum Support International, and we are the largest provider of reproductive and perinatal mental health services. We connect people, fathers, moms, parents of all genders, with the resources that can be the most helpful to them. We have a helpline that you can call into, you can text into. It's English and it's Spanish. Every Friday, we've got dudes and dads only groups where they can come together and talk with other dads that are experiencing a lot of the same. And you can dial into those and just lurk. You can just be off camera. You're there and you kind of listen and see what's what. And oftentimes dialing in that first time, it seems like a mountain too tall. Like, I don't need that. I'm too busy. I don't blah, 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 blah. But a lot of times when we're able to clarify, the dad gets it. Like stuffing it and trying to push through is going to result in you hitting the wall at some point. And it's usually not pretty when it happens. So if you really want to show up for your family, you have to start factoring in that you are one of the most important things that you provide them during this really critical time.
Yeah, then the postpartum support international. You know, can you go a little bit more into what other resources are available and, you know, give out the website, give out the hotline number if you can?
Definitely. The website is postpartum.net, and on it, we have a ton of resources, including a dedicated fatherhood spot with different resources, with handouts, with information about how you can access. The call-in number for the helpline is 1-800-944-4773. And again, the website is postpartum.net. And there, the way the helpline typically works is when you text or you call, that's sort of the main number. And then what they do is connect callers with local people in your area. So PSI is very much a grassroots organization. And most of the people who are local coordinators and who work have lived experience. They themselves have had depression, anxiety, relationship problems, psychosis, substance issues at the same time. And now they want to give back. And so calling in, texting in and saying, hey, you know, I want some resources. You'll get kind of general information about paternal, perinatal and reproductive mental health. But then they're also going to connect you with someone in your community. We have an outreach coordinator in every single county in the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great that the resources are there. So, you know, you're a dad listening to this, some dad out there now is listening to this right now who might be struggling, but is afraid to ask for help. What would you say to him?
I would say to him, it's not just you, man. You are not alone in this. And it isn't your fault. This isn't some weakness on your part. This is a big point of transition. And most of us have some level of stress or distress in really big transitions, like becoming a parent. And there are really well-validated, well-researched therapy approaches that have been shown to be effective for you, this dad. It's not just about, I'm going to go to therapy and emotionally vomit once a week. Now, you can do that, but typically we focus on evidence-based practices where you're working with somebody who gives you tools and resources that you go off and practice, conversations to have, insights to lean into, you know, different kinds of relational hygiene tactics. And Postpartum Support International has an online directory. And you can go online and search in your area for somebody who focuses on dad's issues. Like search parameters are, you could be like, dads, I would like a male, I'd like a female, I want this insurance. And the people that are listed on the PSI online directory, that's not just pay to play. Like, we review everybody. They need to have demonstrated reproductive and perinatal expertise. So that's another really good resource to know about.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Dr. Singley, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on? Do you want our listeners to know about?
Yeah. Father's Day is coming up. And the day after Father's Day, the Monday after Father's Day, we've established as International Father's Mental Health Day, that postpartum support got going. And it's a way to just draw attention that fathers do sometimes struggle, that they do have mental health needs. And for those of you that know a dad who seems like he might be struggling or seems kind of distant or you know, edgy or angry, this is not real complicated psychology here. But ask him, hey, dad, how are you doing? And then wait for the platitude. Wait for the it's all good, like whatever it is. And then once he's done with that, ask him, "Hey, Dad, how are you really doing?" And then just listen.
Wise words there. Thank you so much for talking to Dr. Dan Singley from Postpartum Support International about mental health for new dads. Thank you so much for talking to us, and do really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Yes.
And that was Patricio Rubio for that. Thank you so much. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, Smallwood Porch Fest, a preview next.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, Saturday, the hamlet of Smallwood, New York, will host Smallwood Porch Fest 2025, a day-long celebration of community and Catskill's musical heritage. Set around the shores of Mountain Lake, the event transforms porches, lawns, and driveways into intimate stages featuring more than 10 local musicians. Joining us now is Myrna Markarian from the Smallwood Civic Association and one of the performers, Mr. Cliff Westfall. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So tell us how, Myrna, this came to be and this idea of Porch Fest in Smallwood. I think maybe some people are familiar with the idea of a Porch Fest.
Yeah,
how did the Smallwood Civic Association say, hey, let's do this here?
Well, I used to go to the Porch Fest in Calicoon, which I adored. And I kind of got familiar. I was new up here and I got familiar with a lot of local musicians by doing that, which was great. You had this sort of smattering of different people. And being a musician myself, I felt like it was kind of a nice way to get involved with the local community with music. And, you know, music in this, the Catskills my feeling is there's a renaissance of the arts. There's definitely a renaissance of the arts. It's just bursting out everywhere. And they stopped doing the Calicoon one, so I thought, well, let's do it in Smallwood. So this is our second year. We did it last year. Last year was not with the Civic Association, but this year the Civic Association wanted to jump in. And also the town of Bethel is closing off some of the roads, so we'll have, you know, easy access. The Porch Fest has a route that we'll be traversing around the lake. And then we'll have maps available for people to know where they're going. The musicians that are performing this year I can read you my list.
Yeah,
just a second.
We'd like to hear from all of them, including Mr. Westfall in a few minutes, and we'll hear a bit of his preview
quickly,
here.
Yes, yes.
And one of the great aspects of the Porch Fest is the walkable nature of it as well. You mentioned the lake. How are the performances like timed around there, or are they just kind of ongoing throughout the day?
We have a schedule.
Yeah.
So people will have a schedule. They will start at the beach. If you know Pine Grove Road, you park at the beach. You start at the beach. There's a route that goes around, and you'll be able to walk it pretty easily. And we have 30-minute sets with 15-minute breaks in between to give people time to go to the next one.
That's
so there'll be one performance after the other, and with 30-minute sets. There'll be some interim music. People posted in different places during your walk through. So there'll be kind of music all the time everywhere you are.
And who are some of those musicians?
And
that
the musicians playing this year are Cliff Westfall, who's with us today, Callie Seastrand, Pond Wave, which is Peter from Gorilla Toss, Matt Worden and his wife. Steve Mayone is playing again. Kathy Geary, one of WJFF's own. Yes. Thad Balavelle and Rachel Mandelbaum. Michael Henry and Laura Garone, the Wagner family, Chris Renau, Meredith, Pax, and Todd Hedrick.
How have the community folks in Smallwood come to embrace this idea of having this in their porches and their yards and driveways?
They love it.
Yeah.
It's like a big party. It's like we have this big lake party, and people are like serving snacks and drinks at their houses. And then we have a big jam session at the end.
Cliff, you play all over the place, big stages, smaller venues. How is this for you playing out nature, man?
I love playing locally. You know, it's one of my favorite things to do is to play very casual, informal sets up here surrounded by friends. I know most of the people on that bill, and the others that I don't know personally I've heard of, and I know they're really good. So that's going to be a really fun afternoon.
There's something kind of cool, too, about like folks walking around and sort of discovering your music in the moment, too, right?
Absolutely,
This format.
Very casual and, you know, kind of it's very community.
Yeah,
very,
kind of a big party, as Murta said.
Yeah,
where can folks get more information about it? So that
they can go to Facebook or Instagram. There'll be information there. Also, the Smallwood – There's a Smallwood Facebook page, which all the information will be there. We will provide a link to the schedule and the map.
And there's also smallwoodcivicassociation.org. There's a detail there. The map's already up, too. It looks kind of it looks cool, like walking around the lake, seeing all this kind of music. Cliff's going to give us a little preview of some of the music he's going to play. So take it away, Mr. Westfall.
Thank you. I'm going to do an old song that was – I think the original recording was by Joe Stafford. Definitely was also done by Patsy Cline. People know her version of it. See the pyramids along the Nile. Watch the sunrise from a tropic isle. Just remember, darling, all the while, you belong to me. See the marketplace in old Algiers. Send me photographs and souvenirs. Just remember when a dream appears that you belong to me. I'll be so alone without you. Maybe you're gonna be lonesome too. And blue. Fly the ocean in a silver plane. See the jungle when it's wet with rain. But remember till you're home again, you belong. You belong to me. Yeah, you belong to me.
Cliff Westfall, one of the performers at Smallwood Porch Fest this Saturday, June 21st, from noon to 6 in Smallwood around the lake. And it's free and open to the public. More information again at smallwoodcivicassociation.org. Murta Makarian from the Smallwood Civic Association. Cliff Westfall, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
Can't wait for Saturday now. Yeah. Thank you. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that on the local edition tonight, we'll hear from the two Republican candidates that are vying for sheriff of Sullivan County. Those interviews are tonight at 6 on the local edition. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we wonder about the secrets of nature and meet the scientists finding the keys to the universe, like black hole maven Jan 11.
I think it's really important as a scientist not to put a belief system first. The whole point is to explore the unknown.
Come explore with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Fridays, 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Cloudy today, high 66. Clouds around tonight, low 59. Tomorrow, more of the same, 66.